As a small business, we have always prioritized our underwriting for an HPR as one of the primary marketing investments that we make.
Jim Fitz, Managing Director of the Colony Group, a longtime business supporter of NHPR.
We find that our clients appreciate that support, and also we frequently hear that NHPR is where they first hear our name.
You can learn more on how to reach NHPR's statewide audience at nhpr.org/underwrite.
From NHPR, I'm Peter Biello, and this is The Exchange. State lawmakers are figuring out ways to vote during the pandemic, and there are hundreds of bills to consider on education funding, taxes, voting issues, energy, and the environment. Also on the agenda, crafting a new two-year budget. In this hour, we're going to spend some time talking about what legislative priorities could move forward and which might have to take a backseat in this next session. Also, will the logistics of staying safe during the COVID-19 pandemic diminish lawmakers' productivity? Give us a call as we talk about what lawmakers do and how they plan to do it. 1-800-892-6477. You can also send us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. And with us this hour, we've got Anna Brown, Director of Research and Analysis for Citizens Count, a nonpartisan nonprofit organization promoting civic engagement. Thank you very much for being here.
Good morning.
And we've also got Ethan DeWitt, State House and Politics Reporter for the Concord Monitor. Ethan, thank you for being here.
Morning. Happy to be here.
So let's start with you, Ethan. Last week, while House lawmakers met in their cars for social distance reasons, they learned about the turmoil in D.C., which culminated in pro-Trump extremists breaching security at the U.S. Capitol, leading to mayhem, several deaths, including a Capitol police officer who died from his injuries days later. Governor Sununu said in a statement yesterday, quote, "The American people will never forget January 6th, 2021, a day when domestic terrorists attacked the U.S. Capitol." Ethan, is that the first time he's called members of this mob domestic terrorists?
I believe it is. Yeah, I don't think that he has specifically used that language before. This has obviously been kind of an evolving situation, but I should say that the governor has, as early as the middle of the chaos and on January 6th, he called it un-American. He said it must stop immediately. He kind of came out sort of ahead of it when it was unfolding. And then he held a speech on Thursday. He gave his inaugural address. And in that inaugural address, he didn't, I mean, I thought I was struck by that address because, often when you're giving that kind of speech, you're looking ahead to the accomplishments that you as governor want to give and kind of you as the state and with the legislature in tow want to help kind of bring about. He kind of stayed away from that in this speech. I think that he made a decision to kind of talk to individuals, and he spoke a lot to kind of individualism and how people need to kind of work towards live free or die by working together. And in that speech, there was an implicit rebuke on several points for what had happened, just 24 hours earlier in the Capitol. And he kind of addressed some of the, factors that he saw that kind of led to it. There was one quote that I thought was notable from that speech, which is, quote, "There is a tendency to show too much deference and wrongly believe those individuals are infallible, almost as if they aren't people but deities." And then he also continued by saying, "Holding people accountable to their actions is fine. It's an important feedback response system to getting better results. But to do it in a way where we're tearing each other down, belittling and devaluing other views, and having a complete lack of empathy for our neighbors, well, that is not acceptable." So he didn't directly address it as strongly as he did yesterday, but he has sort of been building up to it. And it kind of dovetails with a little bit of what he's been going through as governor with what he's claimed have been threats against him and his family in the last few weeks.
Yeah, the reason that he moved his inaugural address to a virtual thing rather than something in person for safety concerns, he was concerned about protests turning violent. Ethan, I wanted to ask you about the response from state lawmakers on that day and shortly thereafter. You were reporting on the legislature. So how would you characterize the response from state lawmakers?
Well, it was interesting because this often happens when the House meets, when and it, you know, it happens for reporters too. You kind of get sucked into this bubble. So this was, I'm sure we'll talk about it later, but this was an extraordinary meeting on Wednesday. It was a car park meeting, a drive-in style, and all these lawmakers are sitting idling in their cars with their radios turned to listen to speeches. So obviously that left a lot of downtime for people to be on their phones, more so than you might see on the House floor when people are supposed to be paying attention. And this was as, you know, this, I think they wrapped up around 4 or 5 p.m., the House did. And so this was very much unfolding in real time. But, you know, when you, if for sitting there, you kept getting breaking news alerts. You wouldn't know that there was all this chaos happening for most of the speeches that were coming on until at one point when there was a resolution that was kind of put forward at the end to condemn what was happening again in real time. And at that time, there was opposition. There had been already a lot of party line votes, a lot of kind of hard conversations, I would say, on like partisan lines over kind of whether, you know, the rhetoric has been dialed up too high. And then in the midst of the chaos, even a resolution to condemn what was happening in real time had a significant number of Republican lawmakers voting against it.
I see. We should note that the exchange has invited Governor Sununu to come on the program, but the governor's office has yet to confirm a date that works for an appearance. We'll keep reaching out. We hope to have him on soon. It's also worth noting that NHPR has talked with members of New Hampshire's congressional delegation. We, in fact, talked with Representatives Annie Custer and Chris Pappas on Wednesday while they were hiding in an undisclosed location. All four members of the state's congressional delegation say they support President Trump being removed from or resigning the office of the presidency. Yeah, let's talk a little bit about security locally, because there's been some talk about keeping the state house secure. And I'll get your thoughts on this in a moment. Ethan, while we're with you, what makes the state unique when it comes to public access to the state house?
Yeah, so the state house is one of the most open government buildings in the country. And, you know, there are some people who say that that's rightfully so, but it has been like this for decades. There are no metal detectors when you walk in. There are state police, you know, and there is, you know, internal state house security, but they're not in any means on any given day kind of equipped to keep people out. That's not really their primary role. And the idea is that lawmakers are accessible. You can look up any House member of the House, all 400 members, their numbers are online, and usually that's their home number or their cell phone number. Their addresses are online as well. You can send them letters. And, you know, this is something that has, again, been the tradition in New Hampshire. Ironically, given semi-ironically, given what happened on Wednesday and kind of the players involved, the one time recently when this was different was when Vice President Mike Pence showed up. I can't remember exactly what year it was, but he showed up, I believe, to file for the president's reelection. And at that point, there was the Secret Service took over. Entrances were locked down. There was a metal detector. There was a one entry point in and out. And, you know, people were being screened. And it was unlike anything that New Hampshire had been used to. But that is out of the norm. And there's definitely going to probably be some conversations about whether to change that. But there also are going to be people who have pointed out that this hasn't changed in other crises. For instance, the September 11th, this didn't change, and that it's part of what makes New Hampshire great. There are others who are going to say, you know, this Wednesday crossed the line and demonstrated the fragility of you know, government buildings and of democratic institutions when left unguarded.
Anna Brown of Citizens Count, I want to get your thoughts on this as well. Do you know of any discussion about enhancing security at the State House, given concerns that violence may continue?
Well, the interesting thing to note here is that we're dealing not just with violent security concerns, but also disease-related security concerns, because of course this is all happening in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic. And so most of the conversations I have seen even now are less about the physical security in the building and more about the physical security of human beings breathing on each other, because the State House is the oldest operating legislative building in the United States, the oldest state house that still works as a state house. And so we're looking at a building that does not have great HVAC. The legislative office building, which is across the street, is where they usually hold all their public hearings. And that we're talking little rooms that do not have any sort of great ventilation going on. I know that Ethan and other reporters definitely can talk about how there are many times in the past where you've had public hearings where they're probably breaking fire code. People are packed in like sardines, and we can't have that this year. And so those are most of the debates that I've heard is less about worried about someone showing up with violent intent and more about how are we going to operate in this way that we can have the public safely coming and participating. Because it's true that it's not just about physical access to the buildings in New Hampshire. It's also about meaningful public access to the legislative process. Unlike at the federal level, every single bill in New Hampshire gets a public hearing and every single bill gets a vote on the full House or Senate floor. So if you can't do that in person, how are you going to do it? And right now it still seems to be pretty much in flux for the House. The Senate has decided they're going virtual. They met virtually last week where the House did the drive-in session. And so the House, it looks to be looking to do some sort of hybrid thing where maybe committee members can be in person in the legislative office building, but there's some other virtual connection. But they have yet to make any public announcement about exactly how that's going to work. And House calendar on Friday did not have any public hearings on bills scheduled yet, which is kind of late at this point. Usually you'd have a lot more bill text release and more hearings scheduled.
For listeners who may not be familiar, we should mention that lawmakers in the House last week met in person, but in their cars at UNH. So a giant parking lot. They were listening through an FM channel that they could broadcast to and vote in a specific way, using horns to indicate support sometimes. But that might not continue. And let's talk a little bit about the logistics of how lawmakers might get work done. And we got this note from Representative Christy Dolet Bartlett of Concord, which we edited for brevity. And she wrote, please discuss the costs involved in the recent drive-in parking lot session last Wednesday versus how much less a remote session with a secure remote voting software would have cost. The New Hampshire Senate met remotely and completed their work by 11 a.m. the same day. How can the House afford these costs? That's a note from Representative Bartlett of Concord. Ethan, have you heard any discussion about the cost of meeting in person in that way?
I actually don't know the exact numbers. I'm still chasing those myself. There were some numbers thrown around on the day. There had been, so again, these lawmakers were, just to set the scene, everybody met in what's called Lot A in the University of New Hampshire. It's right next to the Whittemore Center, the hockey arena that the legislature met in before. They were all facing the stage. There was, again, a radio station, so they had to set up that technology to broadcast onto its own dedicated radio station. Everybody had little clickers that allowed them to vote remotely. Some of them didn't work in the back, but, you know, that had to be coordinated. And so there was technology there. And there was a big screen kind of at the front. And so if you were one of the lawmakers sort of within, you know, 200 feet, 300 feet of the stage, and there was an actual stage people could stand on, then you could see who was speaking. But at one point there was, there was some complaints that there weren't more screens, so people in the back couldn't see any of it. And the House Clerk Paul Smith said that had they wanted more screens, that would have been more expensive. And he cited something around the mark of kind of $20,000 that it would have put it over some level there. So I don't know the exact number, but we're looking somewhere in the tens of thousands, I think, that they spent. Now, when it comes to meeting virtually, there's a lot of disagreement here from both. It depends on which party you talk to. Democrats say, you know, you could do this over Zoom. Zoom is well equipped to handle 400 plus people. You know, this has happened in many other cases. And so we can just do that. And that is not, you know, there's not much money that needs to be going to that. The House Speaker's office has over the last few weeks rejected that and argued that actually would be very expensive. And they're using some other technology that is going into that assessment over and claiming that it'll be expensive. The number that was cited last month by Speaker Sherman Packard was $300,000 to set up the technology. Democrats strongly reject that. They say just stick to Zoom. I mean, Zoom is not, the House already has a Zoom account. There's arguments from the Speaker's office about security concerns and needing to create a system that is kind of more workable than Zoom, and that would need a lot of startup costs. So that's kind of where the cost breakdown, the debate comes from. And I think that you're going to continue to see that. We're going to continue to try to report on what the actual costs are of meeting. And one last thing to note, it's worth noting that the House had an opportunity on Wednesday when they met to vote not to require that they meet remotely, but to give the speaker the power to convene them remotely. And so it was a voluntary power from the speaker's office if and when the speaker ever decided to go that route, and they voted it down. They said that the technology wasn't there yet. And so even if the technology does come there yet, they don't yet have a rule in place that allows them, because the House itself voted that rule down. So it creates a lot of uncertainty, and we have no idea what the next meeting is going to look like.
Okay. Well, regardless of how they end up meeting, I want to get into the substance of a few things that they're working on. Anna Brown, you've written about many Senate omnibus bills in particular. So I was wondering if you could give us a quick explainer on these. What are these? How many are there? And what do they contain?
So the Senate last year, they're sort of modeling what they did at the end of last year, except this time they're just doing it up front. So last year, the legislature had to shut down for a couple months because there was no contingency plan at that point for any sort of virtual gathering. And you can't fit that many people into the state house, as we've discussed. So they ended up combining huge numbers of bills into a smaller number of so-called omnibus bills. Now, an omnibus bill doesn't get any sort of special treatment. It just means that it's a lot of different bills, usually on somewhat similar topics, combined into a single bill. So then you don't need to have different public hearings on each of those bills. You don't need to have different votes on each of those bills. It all comes together as a package. So the Senate, between Christmas and New Year's, the Rules Committee decided that we're going to do the same thing at the front of this legislative session. So that means that they're not going to have individual hearings, individual votes on hundreds of bills. They've combined many, many pieces of legislation into about 30 omnibus bills. There are still many other standalone bills, but it looks to me like a lot of this really significant legislation is going to happen in these omnibus bills. So a couple examples, they have one they're titling a COVID bill that it looks to require employers to cover some COVID-19 testing, establish a COVID-19 relief fund, have a COVID-19 needs assessment of nursing homes and long-term care facilities, those sorts of things. There's a Secretary of State request bill that's going to look at lots of things related to election security around elections. So for example, establish a committee to study post-election audits, establish early partial processing of absentee ballots, and so on. So some of these bills cover broader subjects than others. There's, for example, a judiciary bill that covers everything from the legal use of laser pointers to the regulation of hemp. But a lot of the bills are going to be more closely related on topic.
And Anna, is one party control in Concord influencing the substance of these omnibus bills? In other words, because the Republicans can count, if they think they can count on party unity, can they just jam a bunch of unrelated things into an omnibus bill and get it through, whereas they wouldn't have been able to do that if there was divided control in Concord?
That's actually an interesting point. When I was brushing up on some of my political science reading around omnibus bills, since they usually aren't such a big deal in New Hampshire, but they have been a big thing at the federal level. And they're actually more common when there is highly divided government, because when you have an omnibus bill, there's this technique called log rolling. And it's frankly kind of a way of trading votes. So there's the idea is, okay, my side has this bill that we really like, and your side has this bill you really like. And okay, I guess we can tolerate each other and we'll put them together in this bill, and then we'll definitely get enough votes to pass it. So the omnibus bills, I don't think are a result of the single party control. I think that it really is more related to the COVID-19 pandemic. When you looked last year, when the Democrats had control of the legislature, many of the omnibus bills in the state Senate passed on unanimous votes or close to unanimous or voice votes, which is basically when the number of people saying yay is clearly louder than the number of people saying yay. These bills, they depending on how you look at it, they either are a great way of building consensus, or they kind of smooth over what is some important deliberative democracy debates.
Mm-hmm. And Ethan DeWitt,
and I should note,
go ahead.
Yes, I just want to jump in and note that there's also some specific dynamics that work with New Hampshire. And I think we saw them last year. We're seeing them again. Differences between the Senate and the House and how they like to conduct business. Essentially, the Senate tried to do this last year, and a lot of them were
Well, they were ultimately vetoed by the governor, but they were also opposed in some of them were bipartisan bills that kind of, you know, almost unanimous bills that would head over to the House, and then House Republicans would reject them, and House Democrats, who had the majority at that time, would pass them, and then they were vetoed. We're seeing basically there's kind of a suspicion from members of the House on the Senate's way of doing things. And I've talked to a lot of House members on the Republican side, and they're now in power on both sides. And the Senate seems to be moving forward, as Anna was talking about, with doing these packages. And yet there's still a rejection of kind of that spirit in a lot of ways. And we'll have to see how that shakes out the rest of this year. But last Wednesday was a key test. There was a bill. It wasn't quite an omnibus bill, but it did have a number of things. And it was an election bill. It was meant to allow town meetings to postpone. To allow them to postpone in March, because some of them want to meet outside. They want to meet in May or June, and this bill would have let them do that. It also had other, it kind of restored some absentee voting protocols that we saw last year. So it was a few things rolled into one. It passed 24-0 in the Senate. This was, you know, a package that was meant to be fast-tracked so that this could be passed quickly so that the towns could start making decisions now. When it got to the House, it was not even brought up. There needed to be a rule suspension to bring it up. The House didn't bring it up. My conversations have suggested that the House felt that it needed more hearings. And so I think it's kind of emblematic of a problem that has nothing to do with parties in some ways. There's always been some tension between the Senate and the House. And I think that we may see that more where the House, it doesn't like the idea of getting the Senate deciding what needs to pass and what needs to happen and wants to slow things down. And that's what they've done in this bill. And that's what we might see more, especially as the House is still trying to figure out how to meet, and the Senate has figured out how to meet, and not only meet, but meet efficiently and package these bills. So you just see a total cultural difference that may make it kind of difficult, actually, to get some of these priorities that otherwise have broad support across the finish line.
And Ethan, we're going to take a quick break in a moment, but I do want to ask you before we go, is there a deadline by which the House needs to make a decision on how it's going to meet?
There isn't a deadline on that. They have passed a rule that was in effect last year that allows deadlines to be extended. They notably used those rules last year to kind of push the bills down to June, but then they ultimately didn't vote to extend them. So they do have, my short answer is they have the power to meet later. There are some deadlines that are in effect in any calendar. There's something called crossover day when all the bills in one chamber have to go to the other one. We'll have to see how those shape out, because obviously the concerns over meeting have not been ironed out yet. So we don't know how productive this session is going to be.
All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to hone in on environment and energy legislation that lawmakers may discuss this session. Anna and Ethan are going to stay with us. We'll also be joined by NHPR's Annie Ropeek. And we want to know from you, how do you think lawmakers should address environmental issues, whether it's water quality, energy regulation, incentives for renewable energy development? What would you like to see lawmakers accomplish this session? Give us a call now. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. You can also email us. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and coming up tomorrow on The Exchange, we put last week's attempted coup into historical context while exploring how social media and disinformation campaigns contributed to this moment. Right now, though, we are talking about the upcoming legislative session. Lawmakers in New Hampshire have just begun. It's been an unusual start, given pandemic restrictions. And when it's all over, what will lawmakers have done, specifically about environmental concerns? Anna Brown of Citizens Count and Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor are still with us. And along with them now, we've got NHPR's Annie Ropeek. She covers energy, environment, climate change, and the Seacoast for NHPR. Annie, welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning.
And listeners, just a reminder that you can send your questions or comments now. In fact, give us a call. That's the best way for you to join the conversation. The phone number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Email works, too. Send us a note. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Annie, we got this note from Sandra in Manchester. She says, have our state reps discussed the effect of parking lot legislative sessions on pollution and global warming? With all those cars idling, I've heard idling releases more pollution than driving for hours. This forum of sessions sounds like a bad idea. That's from Sandra in Manchester. Have you heard anything about environmental concerns about the way lawmakers are meeting?
Yeah, you know, when I saw those cars idling and thought about, you know, just that whole parking lot of legislators sitting there idling in the cold for hours and hours, that came to my mind too. I don't know the numbers on the effects of that, but I mean, it's true that idling is often like the target of climate and emissions legislation. It's a pretty, you know, easy thing to reduce. Just turn your car off when you're parked. Obviously, in New Hampshire in the winter, that's not such an easy prospect for a parking lot legislative session, but I would be interested to run some numbers on that because, you know, I think that's, it's a health concern too. I mean, if you've ever stood in a parking lot of idling cars, you know, it doesn't, you know, feel awesome to breathe that all in. And for hours of that, for the legislators, I can't imagine that's the most pleasant thing either. So that could be something to keep an eye on for sure.
Well, Sandra from Manchester, thank you for the question. Anybody else, if you've got questions, call us 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange at nhpr.org. Annie, let's talk a little bit about the state of our climate right now. You've spoken recently with state climatologist and UNH associate professor Mary Stampone. What did she tell you about the state of our climate now?
She told me that 2020 was on track to be New Hampshire's fourth hottest year on record. We've seen temperatures in the state, average temperatures, increase about 4 degrees Fahrenheit since industrialization. And a lot of that has taken place just in the past few decades. Dr. Stampone told me that almost all of our top 10, so top 10 hottest summers and hottest years have been in the past decade or two, which just shows you the increasing pace of climate change really on track with what Stampone describes as the business as usual scenario, you know, the scenario where we're doing very little, if anything, to mitigate climate change on a global scale, certainly not anything close to what scientists say is necessary to curtail the worst effects of it. And so those temperatures and our precipitation, also our proclivity for droughts, it's a little counterintuitive, but all of those sort of all that volatility and those extremes are increasing in New Hampshire and expected to continue increasing, really, even if we take serious steps to lower carbon emissions, but certainly even more if we don't.
Well, Annie, let's talk a little bit about things that lawmakers here in New Hampshire are trying to do. You reported on a bill in the Senate that would involve New Hampshire spurring major offshore wind projects and other renewable energy in the region. Could you talk a little bit about that bill? What are the main goals of that bill?
Yeah, so this is what's known as a procurement plan. It's from State Senator David Waters of Dover, but he has bipartisan support. He's worked on this with the state's offshore wind business development kind of commission, which is a bipartisan group that has business representation in it. This bill would have the state require utilities to buy a big chunk of offshore wind and other renewables to a lesser extent, in order to create jobs in the state to sort of help get New Hampshire in on the ground floor of what's a really growing onshore industry all up and down the East Coast. So the state would work with utilities like Eversource to seek proposals for between 600 and 800 megawatts of offshore wind power and other renewables. To put that in context, that's about half to two-thirds of the size of Seabrook Nuclear Power Plant, which is our biggest single generating asset and one of the biggest ones in the region. So this is a huge chunk of power. The state would have a commission and the governor's approval to pick sort of winning projects from those proposals. They wouldn't have to be in New England. This could be really anywhere in the region. New Hampshire would just be sort of requiring the utilities to finance those.
So this bill is not necessarily mandating that wind turbines be put in the Gulf of Maine.
No, and in fact, Senator Waters says, you know, recognizes that wind development in the Gulf of Maine is still, I mean, probably 6, 7, 8, 9 years away. The federal process for that has been delayed by COVID and really was only in its early stages a year ago. So Waters says he's recognizing with this bill that we can't wait for that industry for those turbines to pop up in the Gulf of Maine. You know, the industry onshore will already be in place by the time that development happens, because it's also, you know, building turbines for Rhode Island and Connecticut and New York. And so this would be New Hampshire signaling that it wants to be a part of that kind of supply chain, that like single unified onshore industry that's going to supply these offshore developments as they continue to pop up in the coming years. And that's really Water's goal with this, is job development. He says, you know, any wind development, no matter where it is on the East Coast, will help create jobs in New Hampshire, because there's just only so many places you can build the parts for these things. And so New Hampshire wants to grab a piece of that pie while it can.
Okay. Let's also talk about the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, known as REGGI. Is that coming up for debate in this session?
So usually when Republicans are in control, they try to pull out of the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. This is the Northeast multi-state carbon trading scheme, where they're trying to limit pollution from power plants, and what pollution does occur is sort of priced, and the revenue from that pricing system goes back to the states to distribute as rebates to ratepayers, and also to fund renewable energy and energy efficiency projects. So Republicans have tried to pull New Hampshire out of REGGI in the past. So far, there are no proposed bills or plans for bills that we see listed on the legislative website or that advocates have heard about to do this. But, you know, it's something that is typically expected when Republicans are in control. We don't know if that'll happen this year. But it certainly kind of gets to the broader theme that we are expecting from Republican bills on this topic, which is trying to limit any impacts to ratepayers for funding renewables and clean energy projects, trying to limit sort of the socialized costs of some of these programs that are in place, and preventing any new ones from being created.
Mm-hmm. Anna Brown, I want to get your thoughts on the debate surrounding the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative over the years. How contentious has it been in the past, in your memory?
The interesting thing about the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative is I'm not completely convinced that all of the legislators voting on it really fully understand everything about it and all of the implications, which, to be clear, is not a hit on our legislators necessarily, because let's remember that these are people paid $200 a session plus mileage. They're basically volunteers, and so they can't all be energy policy experts. But we have a question on our survey every 2 years about the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, and a lot of the responses that I have noticed that we get are representatives marking, "I'm not sure, because I really don't know about this program and I need to learn more." So I think that it can be a very difficult and unpredictable debate from session to session, because you have legislators coming in that are forming their positions as they are reading this bill, as they are voting on it. They aren't coming in with this greater knowledge about the issue. And I do really see it boiling down. What ultimately they seem to play with each year is what they're going to do with the residential rebates, which ends up, I'm sure that Annie Ropiek will remember better than me, I forget how much it is on each bill, but it's for households, it's a pretty small amount. I want to say it's something like $1 a month or something like that.
Energy and rebates? Maybe we'll pause for a clarification on that. Annie, can you weigh in?
Yeah, so we distribute the revenue from REGGI to in different ways. So there's rebates that come out of that to households, and then also to businesses, sort of depending on like what class of energy user you are, you get a different amount of money out of REGGI. And like Anna said, it's a really small amount per bill, but it's actually the bulk of the funding overall that New Hampshire gets from REGGI. I think we take, it's like $1 out of every $5. I'm pretty sure that's right for energy efficiency and renewable energy projects that goes into a state fund, but the rest, most of it, is rebated to customers. And Anna's right that that's something that the legislature often fiddles with. You know, you see Democrats trying to increase the renewable and energy efficiency funding that we get out of REGGI. Republicans often try to increase the rebates. And so if we see it come up, not just for repeal, that's also something that could be debated again.
And point taken, it is a complicated issue, and there are terms that need to be defined, not just for lawmakers, but for the general public. So thank you for that, Annie. Annie, I wanted to ask you if there are any other issues that you will be following in this session with respect to energy or the environment.
Yeah, I mean, Anna is right that this is such a complicated topic, and so many of these bills are so detailed and specific and are on aspects of our regulated energy system that very few people understand. And Anna's right, like, it's reasonable to, this is a really wonky area, and and it's not something that lay people are typically familiar with. So even things like the Renewable Portfolio Standard, which listeners may or may not be familiar with, there's a bill that would roll that back, that would basically reduce the state's goal for how much renewable energy the utilities have to sell. Right now, that's ramping up to 25% by 2025, still the lowest goal in the region. And this bill would bring it down to under 10%. That's from Representative Michael Harrington. There's also a bill that would likely try to curtail how much energy efficiency funding the state can require ratepayers to supply on their utility bills. This is a debate that's going on right now at the Public Utilities Commission. We could see some legislative approaches to that issue. And, you know, there are bills from Democrats that I just don't think advocates have high hopes of getting past the House in particular, to do things like establishing a net zero emissions goal for the state of net zero by 2050, which would be in line with our neighbor states. There is probably not going to be a lot of conservative support for that. This is, I think, in part because of how complicated these issues are, typically a pretty party line issue, especially in the House, a little less so in the Senate. So there will be a lot of vote whipping that tries to go on these things, but they are hard to explain. These folks have a lot on their plate. And, you know, as we've discussed, this is not going to be a normal session. So I think it remains to be seen how just how many of any of these kinds of proposals make it over the finish line. And I should just name check net metering as well. Listeners may know that that's been
net metering
going on for years. Yeah.
Well, and Senator Jeb Bradley has been involved in net metering legislation, as far as I understand it. We talked about this a bit. What are the main issues surrounding net metering this time around?
Yeah, so one advocate, it was last year, called the net metering debate at the legislature Groundhog Day all over again, and that was for 2020. Obviously, none of that came to pass, or very little of that came to pass, so we're in Groundhog Day again this year for the net metering debate. This is the state laws that enable customers to generate their own power and sell it back to the grid at a set rate, and so it generally applies to things like rooftop solar, although it can go for things like municipal hydropower dams as well. Democrats are constantly trying to expand the limits on how much of this the state lets people do. Republicans are constantly trying to roll back those limits or keep them in place. There is debate about how much this costs other ratepayers. It's just really not a settled area. Like, depending on who you ask, there are going to be different sets of facts and different numbers that come out. And this is not an easy thing for the legislature to deal with. So we've got all kinds of different compromises and bills that try to make any kind of progress on this. And I actually think advocates are hoping that maybe under Republican control, there could be a compromise on this, because in the past, Democrats have been pretty hard line on this issue. You know, they haven't wanted to compromise. So when the governor and conservatives have come up with sort of middle of the road plans, the Dems have said no to those and have said it's basically all or nothing on expanding net metering. And so some clean energy advocates are hoping that Republicans might be able to make any progress on this, you know, as opposed to none at all, which has been the case in the past few years.
Well, I'd love to hear Anna Brown's thoughts on that.
I just want to jump in.
But go ahead. And Ethan, too. Go ahead, Ethan.
Oh, yeah. I just want to jump in on that. So this is one area that I looked at and I talked to the sponsor. So there is a net metering bill that is limited to cities. And people are looking at that one as having as one of the compromise bills that Annie was alluding to, as having the greatest chance of success. So Sununu has been vetoing some of these bills in the past because of, as Annie has noted, these costs to ratepayers, which are really hard to pin down. The governor claims that they're very high. Advocates say that no, and actually there could be savings, but it's largely been the bills he's been vetoing have concerned net metering for everybody. You know, anybody who has solar panels or a business or a homeowner would be able to expand their generator size. There's an approach that's moving ahead that's just targeted to cities, because a lot of cities have hydropower or are looking to expand into solar projects. And they've been, mayors of cities, both Republican and Democrat, have been writing unanimously letters to the governor over the last 2 years. And so there's a Republican-led effort this year to kind of narrow that down. And again, like Annie said, we'll see what happens there. But I talked to the sponsor of that, and he said that he's following the governor's lead, because the governor, in his own environmental plan recently, he said kind of embraced this idea of expanding for low-income solar projects and for municipalities. And they're, so they're saying, okay, well, you know, like we're gonna take your word for it. Let's see what happens. And so I'm very curious to see how that goes, whether that's the compromise. I talked to the Municipal Association about that, and they're like, this is not what we would like the full bag, but we'll take this. And it's notable that this was attempted last year when Democrats were in power. Republicans said, okay, well, SNUNU vetoed this in 2019. Let's try this in a limited fashion. Let's limit it to cities. And Democrats took that bill and then added all the rest of it that they wanted anyways, as any noted. They've been hard, a bit more hardline on what they want. And SNUNU vetoed it again. Or it didn't pass. But I think that it's... notable that there's kind of a pared back approach this time.
And Anna Brown, your thoughts on net metering?
I was just going to throw in kind of an interesting note because we were talking about the Senate omnibus bills. And so there is a renewable energy omnibus bill that includes some aspects related to net metering. It has bill proposals from people on both sides of the aisle. But then amusingly, there's also just a standalone, and the Senate is calling it Bradley Net Metering Bill. And it's three proposals requested by Senator Jeb Bradley, even though he also has proposals in the renewable energy bill. So it seems like they are putting together several different options of how exactly they can put this together. And we'll probably waiting to see if SNUNU indicates he's more favorable to one or another.
Well, we've got to take a quick break. I want to say goodbye to Annie Ropeek. NHPR's Annie Ropeek covers energy, environment, climate change, and the seacoast for NHPR. You can find her reporting, including all the stories she's done for By Degrees, which is NHPR's effort to tell the story of climate change in New Hampshire and how it shapes our lives today. That's at NHPR.org. Annie, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've got a bit more to talk about with respect to the upcoming legislative session, with respect to voting, education funding, taxes, and, of course, the next budget. What do you think? How should lawmakers go about their business this session? 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Use Facebook, tweet us, or email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. This is The Exchange, and we'll be right back. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you so much for joining us today. New Hampshire lawmakers are getting back to business this month, crafting and debating legislation on voting, taxes, education, and oh yeah, there's another budget that needs to be drafted. We've got two knowledgeable people here to help us preview what lawmakers are expected to discuss. Anna Brown, Director of Research and Analysis for Citizens Count, a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization promoting civic engagement. And Ethan DeWitt, State House and Politics Reporter for the Concord Monitor. We'd love to hear from you on your thoughts on the upcoming session. What do you think lawmakers should prioritize? Call us now, 1-800-892-6477, or email exchange@nhpr.org. We get this email from Denise in Deerfield, who says, "The House's inability to get its act together will have an immediate impact on New Hampshire towns in the upcoming weeks because the House failed to fast-track SB2 to delay deliberative sessions. So instead, we are facing putting 100-plus people in a room in a pandemic in towns across the state. Need I say more? It's reckless and foolish and should be a priority for the House, Senate, and the governor. No excuses. The consequences are real." That's the comment from Denise in Deerfield. Your comments are welcome as well at exchange@nhpr.org or by calling 1-800-892-6477. Let's talk a little bit about redistricting, because that issue is expected to come up as it has before. Ethan DeWitt, what about redistricting? What is the problem that some lawmakers say needs fixing?
Well, the problem is that New Hampshire, the Constitution says that it's, elected representatives are responsible for drawing the districts. And again, drawing the districts is a nonpartisan need. It's not something that is just sort of, you know, we do for fun. There is a need when every 10 years we get an accurate or as accurate as we can portrait of the state's demographics through the census. We need to then change how the districts are. Especially because the districts are meant to be more or less even. And so if you look at, for instance, the Senate districts, there's 24 senators. Senate District 1, if you look on a map of Senate districts, that takes up like almost all of the North Country. All of Coos County is represented by one senator, and that's because it's more spread out. So, I mean, this makes sense. And there's always going to be demographic changes, and they happen gradually, but every 10 years we take an account of that.
Is it related to the census, Ethan? Is it related to the census?
I'm sorry?
Is it related to the national census?
Yes. Yes. Well, the Constitution doesn't state the census directly, but it basically implies that the census is the kind of measurement that lawmakers should use to then apportion. And there are, you know, requirements over how the lawmakers can do that, but they're kind of vague. And that's where there have been lawsuits. There have been, you know, really bitter partisan fights that, again, go to the courts, are decided by judges. This has happened the last two decades that we've tried to do this. And the reason is that it's basically down to whatever party is in power gets to kind of draw the maps, and then gets approved by the governor. So it's a process that, again is constitutional, but it is kind of built into it is this sort of political process. And so there have been attempts by Democrats to say, well, look at what other states have done. Some other states have outside committees that kind of will help like draw up these districts, and there are mathematical ways to do it that are kind of more representative, so that you have districts that are not necessarily safe for one party or another. But those efforts have so far kind of fallen, because there's suspicion of those by Republicans saying that this will just be kind of a shadow effort to do what was done anyways. And if you do it through the House of Representatives and the Senate, then you can kind of, everyone can be out in the open. So that's where the debate kind of falls down on.
So unlikely that we'll see an independent redistricting commission of some kind this session?
They're bringing back efforts, and the problem, there's two problems with that. First is just the fact that Republicans aren't so interested in that, and now they have control over kind of the levers of government, and so there's no naked political reason. But the other problem is that the most effective way to do that would be to change the Constitution, and that's a huge effort, and not something that would likely be able to happen with this political environment, and especially because it would need to kind of clear a much higher hurdle and then go to the voters for a vote. So yes, there are efforts to do an outside independent redistricting commission, but with the governor opposed and with the Republican Party in power, it's unlikely that we're going to see that. So we're going to go back to the normal process that we've seen, the last few decades.
All right. Listeners, give us a call now if you have a question or a comment about upcoming legislation. 1-800-892-6477. And let's go to the phones and talk to Will in Auburn. Will, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
You're welcome. Thank you. I understand the speaker, Packard, and the majority leader, Osborne, from my town, Auburn, are planning to or have filed bills to reduce the business profits tax and other taxes. I'm just wondering what impact that might have on the new budget in terms of revenue.
Good question. Thank you very much, Will. Appreciate the call. Ethan DeWitt, what do you think?
To be honest, I don't know what we're going to see. That's going to be one of the and I know we're not talking about the budget yet, but that's going to be really like the defining legislative fight this year. And this is something that the governor wants right after his election win. I remember on November 3rd, that was one of the things that I asked him, what are you going to do next year? And then one of the first things he said was tax cuts. So the governor is behind it. This is something that obviously they've wanted to do for a while. I don't know what the revenue impacts are going to be. The way that it works is that as the budget kind of moves along, there are new and updated revenue estimates based on what. So the governor comes out with his budget next month, and then the House produces theirs and the Senate produces theirs. So the Senate usually has the most up-to-date numbers on revenue. So we'll see what it looks like. But I think it's a safe bet to say that all three budgets will likely have reductions in these taxes, because leadership in all three chambers, or in both chambers and in the governor's office, have favored them.
Well, Anna Brown, what are your thoughts? I can't remember a time when business taxes didn't inspire a spirited debate in Concord.
Well, I also think that business taxes are one of the issues that Republicans in New Hampshire seem to really be able to unite around, because when we've seen debates such as Right to Work, for example, there ends up not being that clear coalition, even if the governor is supporting it. Whereas when we've done our survey, the number of Republicans that would ever oppose a business tax decrease is tiny. What could change that this year is if we do run into another big tax revenue shortfall because of something else that happens with the coronavirus. The reason why we're talking about this now, though, is because the revenue outlook at the end of last year was looking way better than lawmakers originally thought it was going to be. The deficit is much smaller than what they thought it would be. And so they're looking at this and they're saying, all right, even if there's also potential to have more federal money coming in. I know that President-elect Joe Biden has been talking about a new stimulus plan that he wants to release, and Democrats have been more favorable about giving states and local governments more flexibility about how to spend federal funds. So I would say a business tax decrease is extremely likely going into this year. If I had to pick just two priorities that I've heard Republican leadership in the House, the Senate, and the governor's office talk about, it's been business tax cuts and some sort of school voucher program or some sort of program that would give more taxpayer flexibility in terms of spending those that money on private or homeschooling.
I do want to talk about education before we go, but go ahead, Ethan. I did want to ask you your thoughts on that, and also on whether or not the governor is likely to include federal coronavirus relief money in his budget that may pad the losses expected if the business taxes are cut.
Sure. I just want to say really quickly, I think one thing, kind of wonky thing I'm interested in is just whether there's a trigger. So in the past, when business taxes have been reduced, those have been done when there has been somewhat divided government. They, you know, first under Maggie Hassan's budget, when there were triggers that were set by which the if the revenues hit certain targets, like the taxes could keep reducing. Now that there is, you know, there's obviously going to be Democratic opposition, but there is still, you know, Republicans have much more power than they have in past negotiations. I'm really curious to see whether we're going to see any kind of trigger added on, or whether these business rates are just going to drop, and then just that'll be kind of the hard number that we can see from here on out.
Drop we'll regardless of revenue, out. In other words. So if the state isn't taking
right.
in revenue,
think,
yeah.
Yeah, and to the caller's point, I think that the revenue projections that we start to see, which come out steadily over the, you know, as each budget draft comes out, the legislative budget assistant kind of looks at those numbers and kind of looks at the impact. I think that we will have a better sense of how they affect it, but I think that'll also affect the debate over whether to include triggers at all.
Okay, let's leave aside questions of possible aid from the federal government and the Biden administration for now, because I do want to talk about another major issue, the funding of an adequate education in New Hampshire's public schools. This discussion, of course, goes back years. Ethan DeWitt, what in your perspective is in store for the education funding debate in this session?
Sure. So it's going to be interesting. There was a commission that met all through last year. It was a bipartisan commission. And that commission kind of met. There've been, and I should note, there have been two other commissions that have met in the past on this topic. It's something that just keeps coming up and is never quite resolved. One thing that was intriguing thing that was mentioned by the commission was this idea of that it's often derisively referred to as donor towns. The idea that property, the statewide property tax that is collected, should be redistributed to towns that are quote unquote property poor. Those are towns that have really high tax rates, but the property values in the towns don't sustain. Are requiring them to kind of keep raising tax rates in order to fund the schools. There are other towns that have much wealthier properties, much more valuable properties, then their taxes are lower. And so the idea of this would be for everybody kind of pays a little bit into what's called the swept tax, and that is sent back to towns for anything that's not needed by those towns. And so one of the more interesting proposals out of the bipartisan commission last year was to redistribute that to from towns that have high value property to towns that have low value property. That is something that we'll have to see how that shakes out, because the conditions under which the commission started, again, was Democratic control of the state house. And now we're heading into a year of Republican control of the state house. We'll see if that conversation changes.
We get this note from Beth in Wolfboro, who says, schools closing, education cuts inevitable, and more coming with the pandemic. We need to hear economic solutions for public schools discussed, which helps all New Hampshire students. I hear school choice, money going to a scholarship fund by businesses, their choice instead of having the money go to infrastructure and all New Hampshire needs. I don't get to decide where my tax dollars go. I also hear building charter schools. I would like to see charter school offerings be a spoke in the wheel of public schools rather than have it be a separate entity. Let's give our public schools more options to meet the needs of all kids. Thanks, Beth from Wolfboro. Really appreciate your comments. Anna Brown, with respect to education funding, what will you be watching this session?
Well, the really interesting thing for me was, so I rewind 2 years. Last time we were coming into a budget year, the school was still in a perpetual state of school funding lawsuits. This issue was just as hot 2 years ago, although obviously there were not study committee recommendations and more information at that point. And there were a bevy of bill requests and bill texts that I saw coming out to revise the school funding formula and how those taxes are pulled together. And I did not see a mountain of bill requests like that this year. And mostly what I've seen are small bills, such for example, and once again, it's in a Senate omnibus bill, but it was originally requested by Senator Jeb Bradley, that would give additional state aid just related to special education in some towns under with 1,000 or fewer. So little incremental changes like that seem to be more what Republicans are interested in this point than a wholesale change in the school funding formula. I would hypothesize that maybe Republicans are going to say, we're in unprecedented times. The COVID-19 pandemic has transformed how education is being delivered. Now is not the time for a radical change in school funding. We need to wait until things settle down. That's just me spitballing here, but it definitely seems to be reflected in the bill requests that we're seeing. And to the caller's point, the Republicans do seem much very interested in a debate around funding alternative school options rather than traditional public schools, whether that's going to be charter schools, if it's going to be more scholarships or quote unquote education freedom savings accounts, which would basically be a portion of regular public school funding would be given into an account for a student to spend on private or homeschooling and all the different details that would go into that if there were certain income qualifications or something like that. So that seems to me to be the heart of the debate this year. And I am no longer convinced that there is going to be any major movement on overall public school funding.
Well, Anna Brown, we appreciate your insights. Anna Brown, Director of Research and Analysis for Citizens Count, thank you very much for being on the program today.
Always a pleasure, Peter.
And Ethan DeWitt, State House and Politics Reporter for the Concord Monitor, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And that is our show for today. We could have spoken for at least another hour on this legislative preview, but remember, you can find links to the stories we discussed today at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. Today's show was produced by Ellen Grimm. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Jessica Hunt, Christina Phillips, and Jane Vaughn are producers of the show. I'm Peter Biello. Back with you again tomorrow. Thank you very much for listening.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.